Hey y'all, welcome back to the show. I mean, from yesterday. Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Oh, I forgot to hit the button on that thing there, didn't I? It's libertarian foreign policy, mostly. Mohammed Sahimi's going to be back on the show. Oh, crap, I meant to reread his article this morning and forgot to. But you know what? I'll do it during the break. And then also Jonathan Lande is going to be on the show. He's back in Iraq now. And he's got a new piece about the Islamic State war there to talk about. But otherwise, on the show today, we're going to talk about electoral politics. The Republicans versus... No, I don't care about that. I can't even finish saying versus the Democrats without laughing. No, I don't care about that. Actually, the only thing that that matters there at all is that Harry Reid will do what the president says on Iran sanctions, I think. Whereas, under the Republicans, an Iran nuclear deal is going to be more difficult for the Americans to live up to their end of the deal. So, there's a little something. But otherwise, I don't really know how hard Obama's trying to solve this thing anyway. I guess he's trying. But other than that, I don't think it's going to make much difference. I certainly wouldn't encourage you to vote or anything stupid like that. I'm not voting. All right, so I don't care about that stuff. Today on the show, other than not electoral politics, which we won't be talking about. We will be talking about the Islamic State, this and that. Not just the Lande interview, but I got some news I want to talk about with you here. And then there's a little bit of Ukraine and Israel news I want to cover too. So there's that. Support the show. If you want to support the show, stop by scotthorton.org/donate or scotthorton.org/support. Now, here's the thing. I got a tweet from a lady. It says, hey, you need a QR code for your bitcoins. So now I got one. Before, I had no QR code. Now, I've got a QR code. So if you go to scotthorton.org/donate and you point your QR code scanner at the QR code thingy there, then that's even easier than copying and pasting my Bitcoin address or however the hell you do it. Anyway, and then so blam, somebody sent me a tenth of a Bitcoin, which is all right. That's $30, man. Hell yeah. Thank you very much. It may have been that same person, maybe not. I don't know. But I now have 1.6 Bitcoins. I used to have 12 at one point. If only I had bought thousands of them when they were worth 0.0002 cents each. Oh, well. But now I have 1.59 bitcoins. 1.59184429. That's pretty good, dude. Thank you very much, everybody, sending me bitcoins. scotthorton.org/donate for that. And if anybody donates $100 or more, then you get a QR code commodity disc, which is a 1 ounce silver round with a QR code on the back. It has no face value written on it. It has a QR code on the back. You scan it with your phone. It tells you the instant spot price. You know exactly how much it's worth at any given moment, which I think is just the awesomest thing ever. I think it might need a better name than a commodity disc. Got to work with Arlo on that. Send in your suggested new names. You can't call it a coin, because a coin means a government coin. It's got to be something other than a coin. You guys make your suggestions if you want. I'm sure Arlo's open to the idea of coming up with something better than commodity disc, if that's possible. But what it is it's 0.9999 pure silver. And it's an ounce of it. And you just scan it and it tells you what it's worth instantly. So donate $100 and you get one of those in the mail. I'll get it out within a week or so. You know, sometimes I get behind on getting them out, but I get them out there. That's scotthorton.org/donate. All right, cool. So that's all I got to say about that. Bitcoin, Arlo, mention that. Alright, so yeah. Again, if you're just tuning in, Lande and Sahimi on the show today. One more thing about housekeeping there. Sign up for the podcast feed at scotthorton.org. You can sign up for the whole show or just the interviews by way of iTunes or Stitcher. That's all at scotthorton.org. And if you want to go back through the archives, there's 3,500 of them going back to 2003. And yes, it's true. The first couple of years worth are in a different folder and they haven't been working, but supposedly they will be working again soon. And that will include the Gary Webb interview, which I haven't heard in forever. I don't even know. I bet I'd probably be embarrassed to how poor an interview it is. It was 10.5 years ago I interviewed Gary Webb. But it's a full hour, and I know that I had read about 2/3 of the book at the time. I hadn't even finished the book at the time, so it's not all-encompassing. But I had read the hell out of it and taken some notes, and anyway, you can find it on YouTube. But soon again, it should be working there at scotthorton.org, and there's a lot more than that. More than 3,500 of them, going back to 2003. And by the way, if you want to hang out in the chat room during the show, it's scotthorton.org/chat. Live here noon to 2 weekdays. Yeah, I dropped the third hour because I just got too many other things to do. But noon to 2 weekdays here, Eastern Time, on the Liberty Radio Network. And join up the chat room there, scotthorton.org/chat. Got a few guys in there today. Hey, everybody. How's it going? Lande, Sahimi, coming up on the show. All right, cool. All right, so I want to start off with this war propaganda from Reuters, and I don't really know exactly how true this is. I'm not familiar with either of the names on the byline here, but it all seems very credible, honestly. It's about life under the Islamic State in Fallujah, and they interview a tailor whose new job is making suicide belts and vests for these guys. Hey, it's a living, he says. More or less, you know. I passed through hard times. I have children to feed. I chose this new profession willingly, and I take responsibility for the outcome, he said. But they talk about how they've banned cigarette smoking. They've banned all Western-style haircuts and clothes, or at least T-shirts with any English writing on them. This kind of thing. And like Saudi Arabia, and unlike Iraq, like Saudi Arabia, they have insisted on full head-to-toe, they're not burqas. I don't know what exactly is the difference that makes it a hijab versus a burqa. A burqa's blue, and on the other side of Iran from there, I don't know. But anyway, and they're not allowed women and girls are not allowed to travel anywhere without their brother, husband, or whoever. So, this is a problematic problem from the point of view of the people of Iraqi Sunnistan, who are actually not a bunch of religious kooks like this. Salafism is mostly in the Arabian Peninsula and in North Africa, and has had, and not even that much there, really, North Africa. But, you know, the Al-Qaeda in Iraq guys, they wore out their welcome really fast. Now, when Donald Rumsfeld hired the Bada Brigade for his El Salvador option in 2005, and that meant the Shiite sectarian militias, and hired them to clamp down and said, you know, basically, we'll help you. Just tell us who all your enemies are and we'll kill them for you, kind of deal was what he did. And so the Sunnis then, being targeted and isolated and marginalized by the Badr Corps and the Americans, they sided with Zarqawi and the Islamists. But especially after the death of Zarqawi in 2006, they got really sick of the so-called Islamic State of Iraq back then, bossing them around. They completely marginalized them. It wasn't Petraeus who did it. It was the Iraqi Sunnis, and I think they'll do it again. Best without our help, probably. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still. If you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Oh yeah, I knew there was one more bit of housekeeping I want to talk about before I get into the substance of this and that today, and that was SU. T-S-U. It's the new ripoff of Facebook, and supposedly it pays you a little bit for posting stuff and getting eyeballs on your posts. So far I've made 1 cent, which is great, but that's not the thing about it, or maybe it is, but here's my thing about it. I hate Facebook. Now, here's my attitude toward Facebook. Vendetta! I want to see Facebook destroyed just the way that MySpace was destroyed. MySpace, I think mostly because they just insisted on having the static background with the moving text in front that just made it completely unvisible and workable and ridiculous, and they just wouldn't fix it, and so everybody just dropped it immediately and went to Facebook. All at once, within 2 months or something. Buy MySpace, done. And also, you know, I think it was the day after Rupert Murdoch bought it, or the day before he bought it. Once it started going downhill, that was when he paid $1 billion for it, or two or three or whatever. Anyway, I want to see that happen to Facebook. And here's why. Because of the algorithms. Anything that's got Al Gore in it in the first place, you know you're going to hate, right? But so the algorithms at Facebook, they suck. And I remember when they first changed the feed from everything you want to see to everything we want to show you, I remember thinking, this is so horrible that they're going to have to change it back. Yeah, right. Like they're going to have to repeal the Patriot Act or something, right? Yeah, they're going to have to do nothing. And so I realized, geez, I just posted a thing about a cop shot a child, and then it got one share and one comment, even though I got 6,000 friends on Facebook. Now, I know it's not that nobody cares. I know it's that Facebook will not show my posts to anyone. And, so, screw them. Who am I? I'm posting for myself? I can do that over at the stress blog. Anyway, so I just want to see Facebook destroyed, and I think the first thing you'll think when you see Sue is it's just Facebook, only it's green. It's the exact same thing. It's an exact ripoff. Well, good. Because I always thought that the Google Plus thing sucked. All the circles and this and that. That sucks. Make it just like Facebook, only without the stupid algorithms. If 6,000 people want to see my posts, show my posts to 6,000 people. And then they claim everybody gets a cut. Who knows? You know, anyway. I don't know if Sue is the next big thing. Maybe it's Elo, which I'm not on. Maybe it's some other thing. Somebody suggested there'll be... There must already be. Somebody must be working on an open source type Facebook where there is no Facebook. Just everybody has it. It's just a plug-in on our browser or something where we all have basically a Facebook just in our own browser and networked together in the same kind of way. And there is no Facebook to screw us with the algorithms or anything else. That seems to make the most sense to me. It is almost 2015. So, someone could probably write that code, right? Anyway, I'm on there, sue.co, T-S-U, sue.co/Scott Horton Show, if you want to sign up, if you want to join up. And already I'm seeing a lot of old friends from Facebook. I quit Facebook back in April. I'm not even doing Facebook at all. I hate Facebook, screw Facebook, I'm over it, I quit. But I'm already seeing friends from Facebook over here, friend of me and this kind of thing. So that's cool, man. Maybe it'll turn into a thing. Oh, and it'll let you push to Facebook and Twitter. So you can stay on Facebook anyway, kind of. In fact, these are the first times I've been posting to Facebook, is all I got to do is hit a button and it automatically pushes to Facebook without even being on stupid, evil Facebook. So whatever, you know, 20 people Facebook will show my posts to, we'll be able to see them. Like, for example, the post I just posted, today's show, Mohammed Sahimi and Jonathan Lande. So I don't know if Sue is it. I'm not advertising for it. I'm not putting all my eggs in its basket. I don't have any eggs. I'm just saying I hate Facebook. And if you also hate Facebook, hey, maybe leave it. And go over here. If you want. Mm-hmm. All right. Boy, do I get a lot of spam. Woodworking made easy. I actually, you know, could probably read up on some of that, but I'm afraid to click a link in a spam, you know? Probably isn't about woodworking at all. Ukraine. Let me talk about Ukraine real quick, since I'm almost out of time. I've wasted this whole segment almost, and we're getting back to the war and all that later. But I just wanted to talk real quick here about Poroshenko. That's the prime minister, the president, pardon me, of Ukraine. He threatens to end the Ukraine truce after the eastern elections, which he says was a violation of the ceasefire. But who cares about that? Check this out, man. Dmitry Yarosh, and I had missed this because I just wasn't paying close enough attention, man. Hey, there's a lot of wars going on and other things. Dmitry Yarosh, the leader of the Nazi right sector, the Privy Sector, they call him, has won, is being seated in the Ukrainian parliament. Oh no, the maiden thing. There's no Nazis there. Oh, only five, and nobody supports them, and they don't have any power. And yeah, well, here Dmitry Yarosh, not just the Svoboda Nazis, but the right sector too. And I guess the right sector, they're more like the just kind of brown shirt street thug, you know, murderer types. Whereas the Svoboda, they're more like the Nazi party. These guys are more like the Nazi party's brown shirts. But anyway, got their own seat in the American coup d'etat government in Kiev now. That's funny. Yeah, Robert Perry wrote at Consortium News something along the lines of, man, you would think that actual Nazis going into battle in Europe for the first time since World War II would be a newsworthy thing. But it's not. And why? Because it's America and Germany behind it. It's the Americans backing the Nazis. And these guys, yeah, they're legit Hitler-loving Nazis. They are the sons and grandsons of the guys that fought for Hitler in the Galician SS, who massacred Poles and Jews in the Holocaust, who proudly display their Wolfsengel, which is their version of the swastika. It looks like a big capital N with a vertical line through the middle of it. It's the wolf's hook, and that's their brigade. That's the symbol of their part of Hitler's SS and from back then. And, yeah, that's their thing, man. As the right sector member told BBC Newsnight, he said, hey, look, all we want is a clean country. Oh, man, you know where that's going right away, don't you? Hey, all we want is a clean country, he says. Not like Hitler. Well, okay, a little bit like that. Yeah, just a little bit. Yeah, this is the curse of the old world, all the kind of ethnic purity and the mismatched nation-state borders around the different ethnic lands and whatever. It'll be unending conflict forever. But in this case, we're the American government is on the side of real, no fooling, Hitler-loving Nazis like Dmitry Yarosh from the right sector. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our first guest today is Mohammed Sahimi. He's a professor of chemical engineering and materials science at the NIOC Chair in Petroleum Engineering at USC in L.A. I miss L.A. Good old L.A. Hey, he also writes for antiwar.com, original.antiwar.com/Sahimi. And oh no, now I'm realizing that I'm not prepared. Your own news website is ME News something. I'm going to get it wrong, Sahimi. Please tell me.
Good morning, Scott. It is Iran News and Middle East Report, imenews.com.
imenews.com, right. Hey, welcome back. Good to have you back on the show. Great to talk to you again. Great article here for antiwar.com. I really urge everybody listening to take a read through this thing. We ran it yesterday there. You'll find it in Muhammad's archives there, original.antiwar.com/Sahimi. If nuclear negotiations with Iran fail, U.S. will be blamed. And it's a really good piece because, well, you got that right, the headline. But also just the substance, the way you take us through here and explain the issues, what all the issues were, what's been resolved, what's outstanding and why and what can be done and, you know, which politics are trying to screw it up and everything else. It's a really great piece. I really hope everyone will take a look at it. And so let's start with, as you do in the article, Iran's concessions and the issues that were, and again, everyone understands, I hope, in this audience that the Iranian nuclear weapons program is just a giant fake red herring of an issue, but it's still the single largest outstanding issue between America and Iran preventing an end of our Cold War. So it's very important that we get this resolved, even though they never were making nukes, and we all know that. But anyway, so we have all these supposed concerns. Mohammed, if you could please take us through the ones that, as you start with here, have already been resolved.
Yes, there were several issues that have been resolved. The first issue was Iran uranium enrichment facility in Fordo, south of Tehran, that Iran had built under a mountain. And because it was built under a mountain and military experts in the United States had said that it cannot be destroyed by bombing, the U.S. had demanded that Iran should close the facility and get it over with. But Iran has said repeatedly that they will not close the facility. So what seems to have been agreed on is that Iran made a major concession by agreeing to convert the facility to a research facility, so that most of the centrifuges that are there would be basically set aside so that they cannot be used for any enrichment facility. As I mentioned, enrichment activity, as I mentioned in the article, Iran probably built the facility in the first place for one of the two reasons, or maybe both. One was to use it as sort of a bargaining chip so that it can extract some concession from the West, because, as I said, it cannot be destroyed by bombing. And second, when they built these several years ago, there was great concern in Iran that the West can bomb the Natanz facility, where most of Iran's centrifuges are, and therefore nothing would be left of all the things that Iran had done and assembled together for uranium enrichment that Iran wants to use in its nuclear reactors. So now Iran has agreed to basically stop enriching uranium at Fordo. So that was one issue. The second issue was the Arak heavy water reactor. Iran has a medical research reactor in Tehran that has been in operation for almost 50 years, since 1967, and it was actually originally donated by the U.S. to Iran. But Iran had to redesign it in 1982 because it ran out of fuel, and the U.S. was not willing to supply Iran with fuel for that reactor. So Argentina redesigned it, but its useful life is coming to an end because most reactors don't work properly beyond 45 to 50 years. So Iran designed and started constructing a replacement for that reactor, which works with heavy water. But the problem with heavy water reactor is that its nuclear waste contains a lot of plutonium. And the concern was that Iran may use to try to use that plutonium for bomb making. So Iran, on its own initiative, suggested that first of all they will redesign the reactor, they would change the reactor the way it is built right now, so that first of all it will produce much less plutonium, And secondly, Iran has agreed not to set up any reprocessing facility, because although the plutonium exists in the nuclear waste, it has to be separated from the rest of the waste so that it can be used for any purpose that they want to use. So Iran has agreed to not to build any reprocessing facility. Now, here is an important point. Iran has agreed not to set up any reprocessing facility, but in the 1970s, actually the Ford administration had urged Iran to build a reprocessing facility for nuclear waste in Iran, not only for Iran's future nuclear reactor, but also for the entire region. So that's a sort of a historical note that we should take note of. So that was another important issue that apparently has been resolved. The third issue is the very fact that Iran has agreed to limit the number of centrifuges that it can have for the duration of the comprehensive agreement that they are trying to reach with the United States. And as we know, the safeguard agreement that Iran signed with the International Atomic Energy Agency in 1974 and is still in force puts no limitation on the number of centrifuges that Iran can have. But because of the apparent concern by the West that Iran may use those centrifuges for anything other than a peaceful purpose, which Iran, I never believed that Iran had any intention of, Iran has agreed to limit its number of centrifuges for the duration of agreement. So many, the most important issues seem to have been resolved. Now, what remains is that, first of all, how many centrifuges Iran can have.
Well, hold it right there for a second. Yes, I just want to go ahead and recap here real quick, make sure we got caught up here and understand. So their secondary enrichment facility that they built at COM, the one that's basically bomb-proof, hidden under the mountain there, they've agreed to no longer enrich, especially not up to 20% anymore. That's not even on the table. Hasn't been for a while. They're not even going to have an enrichment plant there at all now. It's just going to be a completely worry-free research facility. Then they're going to change the configuration of the Bushehr reactor, and they're going to change the configuration of their other IR-40 reactor from which is at Iraq there.
No, they won't reconfigure the Bushehr reactor, because that's a light water reactor.
Oh, that's already the light water reactor.
Yeah, this is light water, because it spent fuel is shipped to Russia.
So now that was already the deal, though, wasn't it?
That deal was already in place, so there is no concern about that. And the IR-40 in Iraq will be reconfigured.
I see.
So that it will produce less plutonium, and Iran will not reprocess the spent fuel, right, so that it cannot separate plutonium from it.
And as you say, they would need a whole new facility in order to do that reprocessing,
exactly.
And they've pledged not to even build one.
Exactly. And you pointed out an important point that I had forgotten, actually. Now I realize I had forgotten to mention in my article, and that is Iran has agreed to stop enriching uranium at 20%. Iran had already produced enough 20% fuel for Tehran Research Reactor as long as it operates, so that by the time the IR-40, the reactor in Iraq, comes online, it will have enough fuel. So Iran has agreed to stop that. Again, this is not part of the safeguard agreement, but Iran has made a major concession here by agreeing to stop that enrichment.
Right. Okay, now when we get back from this break, we'll talk about the rest of this manufactured controversy and how much of it can possibly be put to bed, and Mohammed Sahimi's bet and odds, if I can get you to bet, Mohammed, what you think the chances are for a final deal here by the end of this month. It's the Scott Horton Show. Back in just a sec. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Talking with Mohammed Sahimi from USC and IMENews.com. imenews.com. This piece is at antiwar.com, original.antiwar.com/Sahimi. And it ran yesterday on the page there. If nuclear negotiations with Iran fail, U.S. will be blamed by Mohammed Sahimi and by Scott Horton and by the other, I don't know, a few dozen people in America who understand this issue outside of those persecuting the horrible policy here, perpetrating it, implementing it. We covered what the Iranians have been willing to negotiate away so far. And then let me just catch the audience up here real quick, Mohammed, on the fact that Iran has been a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty since it was invented and since back in the Shah's day. And they have what's called a safeguards agreement with the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is sort of like the international nuclear ATF cops. And the agreement says that the IAEA can inspect Iran's nuclear facilities to make sure that they're not diverting nuclear material to any nefarious purpose. So their centrifuge enrichment program is perfectly legal as long as it's safeguarded, which it is, which it always has been. So what exactly is the controversy here, Mohammed?
Well, the controversy is, one of the main issues is the so-called breakout time, which means that if Iran decides to leave NPT and expel IAEA inspectors from Iran and then rush to enrich enough highly enriched uranium for making a bomb, how long would it take to do it? The U.S. has demanded that the breakout time, the so-called breakout time, should be at least 1 year. Now, here is the controversy. The breakout time depends on a large number of factors. For example, how efficient your enrichment facility is and how fast it can produce highly enriched uranium, what type of centrifuges you use, and even if you succeed in all of these, do you have the technology and know-how to convert your nuclear device or crude nuclear bomb to some sort of a warhead that can be placed at the top of your missile so that if you want to deliver it somewhere, you can. Now, first of all, there is no evidence that Iran has such a know-how for miniaturizing the nuclear device into a warhead. And secondly, there is no evidence that Iran actually wants a nuclear bomb. And third, it all, as I said, it all goes back to what enrichment technology you have, how efficient it is, and what you want to do with it. Iran has said consistently that it wants to enrich uranium for its Bushehr reactor, and in fact, they are signing an agreement with Russia to build two other nuclear reactors in Iran, and another one, not IR-40 that I mentioned, but another one is under construction in Iran, in southwest Iran. Therefore, in the next few years, Iran will have at least four nuclear reactors and needs fuel for it. But what has been basically talked about in Washington by people like David Albright and people like him is that Iran should limit the number of its centrifuges because they have based their theory for breakout time solely on the number of centrifuges. And in this argument that they have actually convinced some members of Congress, the pro-Israeli members of Congress, that Iran should not have a large number of centrifuges, if at all. Now, as I mentioned, and you also summarized it very nicely, all the concessions that Iran has made are actually the rights that it is entitled to under Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and its safeguard agreement. So Iran has actually given up a lot of its legal rights for the duration of comprehensive agreement, and there is no evidence that Iran actually has any secret facilities or has any intention of making any nuclear bomb. And as you mentioned, this was a basically manufactured crisis that way Gary Porter put it, by pro-Israel and neocons in the United States. So that is one issue. The other issue is what they refer to as possible military dimension of Iran's nuclear program, which means that Iran may have had some activities in the past that could be related to the attempt to make a nuclear weapon. Now, the whole basis for this possible military dimension of Iran's nuclear program is supposedly a laptop that existed in Iran and contained a lot of documents about Iran's past activity and was stolen, brought out of Iran, given to Western intelligence agencies. And then the IAEA started pressing Iran to explain this. Now, here is the important point. Iran has said that if it is shown the documents and if it is shown to be authentic and not fake, it will explain everything. But the IAEA has refused to present Iran with any actual documents and has just said that, that's the evidence they have. It has been corroborated by other Western intelligence agencies and so on. Here again, David Albright of Institute for Science and International Security, ISIS, which I call it a non-jihadist ISIS, has again propagated the idea that Iran has had some research activity and some technology development in the past related to manufacturing of a nuclear bomb, and therefore Iran must explain these things. Now, in this, he has actually aided those who want to pressure Iran and, if even if possible, maybe attack Iran at some point. One of the aspects of this possible military dimension is the allegation that Iran, back in early 2000, before 2003, made some experiments in a military facility in south southeast Tehran, near Tehran, 40 kilometers southeast Tehran, in which they experimented with high explosives that are conventional high explosives, but they can be used for triggering a nuclear reaction, which will lead to a nuclear bomb. Now, these allegations belong, as I said, to many years ago. Back in 2004, Mohammad al-Baradei, who was Director General of IAEA at that time, demanded that Iran allow IAEA to visit this military facility, which is called Parchin, and to see for themselves whether any evidence there is. And let me also mention that these allegations were first brought up by John Bolton, Under Secretary of State for Proliferation and a non-Iran hawk and pro-Israel guy. Anyway, although Iran was not actually obligated to allow IAEA to visit Parchin, because Parchin is not a nuclear site, and Iran was implementing the additional protocol of safeguard agreements, which means that Iran was obligated to allow IAEA if it was enforced, if it was ratified. IAEA visited Parchin in 2005 twice, and both times its delegation of inspector was led by Ali Hainonen, who was Deputy Director General at that time for safeguard. And we know Hainonen has a very strong reputation for being anti-Iran. Mm-hmm. They visited Parchin twice, and they didn't find any evidence. And as I mentioned in the article, at that time, the Iranian press reported that Ali Hainonen had told Iranian officials that the Parchin case has joined history. And in other words, there was no evidence, the case is closed and finished.
Well, but now, haven't they decided now that they're going to go ahead and drop this as the so-called possible military dimensions as one of the sticking points, and probably because it's such obvious debunked nonsense? I mean, even Robert Kelly, the IAEA inspector himself, has, completely debunked this whole thing.
Well, when Yukio Amano became director general of IAEA on December 1st, 2009, he decided that he wants to revive the issue because he claims that what the evidence that they originally had, which Ali Hainonen had talked about it in February of 2008 in a meeting of Board of Governors of IAEA, has now been corroborated by other evidence that they have gathered from other sources. But he doesn't mention what these sources are and what this evidence are, evidence is. So he revived it, and he refuses to set aside their story. As you said, it's fake, but they persist in pushing this issue. And again, particularly regarding Parchin, David Albright did a great disservice. Back in 2004, his institute issued report after report after report that something is going on in Parchin and Iran must allow the IAEA to visit Parchin. When the two visits took place, no evidence was found. The man never retracted anything. He never apologized for anything. And now that the Parchin issue has been revived again, he has been issuing again one after another report claiming that something is going on here. And just a few weeks ago, when there was apparently an explosion in the military side, he again tried to somehow link it to the allegation about experiments with high explosive and has issued reports about it, satellite images about it, and so on and so forth. So this is basically the breakout time, which I mentioned, is the a sticking point, apparently, related to the number of centrifuges that Iran can have. Now, the latest report that was broken first by Garrett Porter last week, but I had read it in the Iranian press, is that the two sides are discussing a way out of this impasse by Iran agreeing to ship its enriched uranium to Russia for conversion to fuel rods and fuel plates, even though Iran has the technology and know-how in Iran to do this and has been doing this. But Iran has agreed to ship it out, apparently, they are discussing it. Iran has not formally agreed to it, to ship it out to Russia to be converted to fuel rods and fuel plates so that at any given time, Iran's stockpile of enriched uranium in Iran would be low enough that cannot be used for making a nuclear bomb. If that agreement is actually reached, then basically the problem, most of the problems are solved. The only remaining issue would be what would be the duration of the comprehensive agreement. Iran has said that it's willing to go with a seven-year agreement, but the U.S. has said that they want an agreement whose duration has two digits, which means at least 10 years. Iran has said 7 years because for the next 7 years, Iran will receive fuel for its Bushehr reactor from Russia, but wants to be in a position after 7 years so that it can start producing large-scale amount of enriched uranium for Bushehr reactor. So that's another issue. And finally, the remaining issue is how would the economic sanctions that U.S. has imposed on Iran be lifted? Obviously, the Obama administration cannot cancel most of these economic sanctions because they were approved by Congress and they require approval by Congress also to be canceled. But the Obama administration has said that it will suspend the economic sanctions. And apparently, Iranians have said that as long as they are suspended, it is good enough for them because they believe that once they are suspended and once Iran demonstrates that it is really implementing its part of the bargain, then the sanctions will collapse, no matter, regardless of whether the Congress will approve its cancellation or not. So that's where we stand right now.
All right. Well, I don't know. Let me ask you this. It's, I guess, a little bit more to the speculative part of this. But it seems like, and I know the electoral politics of today's elections probably play into it and what happens with the if the Republicans take the Senate and this and that. But I wonder if you think that the fact that Obama is finally, I mean, after screwing around his whole administration long, finally beginning a year ago, he seemed to really try to get this thing together and tell Kerry, no, really, I mean it. Go ahead and start working on a deal here. It seems like he means to see it through. And, of course, you know, he's the president. He can bomb any country he wants. He can do whatever he wants, right? So it seems like if he really wants a nuclear deal, then he can have a nuclear deal too, right? And so I just wonder, you know, I guess maybe that obviously is an oversimplification a little bit, and there's still an Israel lobby on the Hill and all that kind of thing. But I just wonder whether you think that – have you seen indications to make you confident that the president really means to see this through and figure out a way to do it? Clearly, the Iranians are willing to bend over backwards to make this deal. What about the American president?
I think, in my view, the president does want a nuclear agreement with Iran. Not only for its own sake, because this has been, you mentioned it at the beginning of the program, that this has been a very important sticking point in the Cold War between Iran and the United States. And I think the president does want to remove this issue so that maybe the relation between Iran and the United States will improve. But at the same time, I think the president and his administration recognize that with all the problems in the Middle East, you know, the ISIS war in Iraq and Syria, the war in Syria itself, the radical Sunni extremist group that are supported by U.S. allies in that region, such as Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and United Arab Emirates, and given the influence that Iran has in not only in Iraq, but also in Afghanistan, in Syria, in Lebanon, and given the experience that Iranian forces have had in fighting these terrorism, because one of the things that is not mentioned in this country is that Iran itself has been a big victim of terrorism. There has been all sorts of terrorism activity against Iranian people inside Iran, and these terrorist groups have been supported one way or another by U.S. allies in that region and perhaps even indirectly by the United States itself. So the president recognizes that in order to address some of these important issues, it needs Iran's help. And Iranians have made it clear that if the nuclear issue is resolved to satisfaction of both sides so that Iran preserves its right to enriching uranium and nuclear technology, then Iran will be willing to help the Obama administration and the West to address some of these very important issues, bloody issues in the Middle East. And we have to remember that, again, this is not mentioned very often in this country, back in 2003, the Khatami administration, the former Iranian, reformist Iranian president, had put on the table a comprehensive proposal by which Iran would limit its nuclear program for a long time and would also help the United States to resolve some of these issues in the Middle East, such as Palestine-Israeli issues, Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas, and so on. But the Bush administration at that time was basically drunk of its so-called victory in Iraq and rejected it out of hand. So now that is being revived again, because now the situation is much worse than it was back in 2003. And Iran is, in fact, in a much more powerful position regarding all the things that are happening in the Middle East. So in my view, the president does want to reach an agreement with Iran and resolve this and basically remove it from the agenda. Now, whether in this effort he will be hindered by Congress and pro-Israel lobby, I'm sure they will do their best, but whether that would actually stop the agreement, that remains to be seen.
All right. Well, we've got to stop right there. We're right up against the limit here, but thank you so much for your time, Mohammed. It's great to have you back on.
Thank you, Scott.
I really appreciate it. All right, so that's the great Mohammed Sahimi, professor of chemical engineering and materials science at USC. Original.antiwar.com/Sahimi. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. darrenscoffee.com. All right, y'all. I'm Scott. Welcome back to the show. Just got off with Mohammed there. I kept him through that whole top of the hour break to finish up. I really like that guy. He's good. Original.antiwar.com/Sahimi and IME News. Man, where the hell is the RSS feed for this thing? So I can keep on top of this. Huh. Well, I'll have to find it later. Anyway, imenews.com there for more Mohammed Sahimi. All right, coming up on the show, Jonathan Landay on the war. I wanted to mention one more couple of things about the Iran nuclear issue there. Well, I guess just one more thing and then I'll drop it. Over at emptywheel.net. Marcy's colleague Jim White has a piece, Glaring Front Page Error by David Sanger, New York Times, as Iran nuclear negotiations near deadline. So here we are, most important time for this final comprehensive deal. And David Sanger, boy, he just can't even get it right. It's probably because of all those years of lying. He's got all confused about what he's supposed to believe and what he wants us to believe and what's the truth and what he would have us think is the truth. And so, New York Times, newspaper of record, lead reporter on the Iran nuclear issue. And he says, oh yeah, you know, they're going to have the Russians enrich the uranium for them. What? No. The whole point, as Muhammad was just explaining, as Gareth explained on the show last week, is have them ship all the stockpile to Russia. That way they can enrich all they want. They can have spinning centrifuges aplenty because they won't be keeping a stockpile. They'll be transferring it all to Russia for transformation into fuel rods. Now, how in the hell do you call that enrichment? How do you say that? How the hell do you call that enrichment, David Sanger? You know, it'd be fun. Let's Google search. CiteNYTimes.com, Sanger, Iran, and then in quotes now, nuclear weapons program. See, Iran, they never had a nuclear weapons program, and yet David Sanger at the New York Times, why, he's as bad as George John of the AP. 697 results for David Sanger claiming they have, and oh, here he is, their illicit nuclear weapons program. He just asserts it over and over and over again. Try it yourself. It's a lot of fun. CiteNYTimes.com/Sanger/Iran/ nuclear weapons program, unquote. And you'll see the same thing as me. Hey, this guy David Sanger, why, he's a liar. All he does is lie all the damn time. I wonder what his problem is. Well, yeah. He's no good. That's why he can't get his facts straight. He doesn't know what the facts are anymore. That's not really his job. And again, back to the possible military dimensions, so-called documents, questions, etc. Gareth Porter has so destroyed and debunked this. Forget about it. Give me a break. Even Robert Kelly from the IAEA himself has, you know, piped up to say, excuse me, this is a bunch of crap. And Gordon Prather, who actually knows how to make an H-bomb in real life, told me himself. He's a friend of mine. He used to write for Antiwar.com. You should go read his articles. You'd like them. And Gordon Prather told me, that's not how you test an implosion system anyway. This whole leak is a bunch of nonsense. You know, they might as well be claiming that I'm practicing making nuclear bombs over at my house. Well, that's funny because that's just not how you do it, you know? They claim you have to have this implosion chamber and all this. Well, no, you got to do it outside. And you have to have all this stuff that there's no evidence Iran has. The ability to take super high-speed X-ray footage of the implosion of inert materials like depleted uranium or lead or other heavy metals in order to test the implosion system. They'd have to do that hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times over in the daylight. Or at least, you know, maybe a big roof without walls, but no, yeah, pretty much it would have to be just outside on the testing table. That's how they do it. And in fact, Gordon even like authorized me to claim that I know that because he taught it to me, and that's it. Simple as that. You know, I'm not asking you. I'm telling you. You don't test an implosion system for a nuclear bomb in some chamber like David Albright and the rest of these kooks claim. David Sanger. The Israelis and their forged documents claim the Iranians are doing. It's a bunch of debunked crap. Anyway, just so you know. Israel announces another 500 settlement units in East Jerusalem. State Department says that announcement is contrary to Israel's commitment to peace. Oh, they have a commitment, do they? A commitment to peace, you call it. Is that right? They say it's a massive diplomatic crisis. Again, somebody used a bad word. Obama sent one of his underlings to use a bad word to call the Prime Minister of Israel chicken S. And yet the entire context was dropped. On all the coverage I saw on TV, it was all about, oh, the reaction to being called a name and the reaction to the reaction of being called a name and the denial to the reaction to being called a name. But what was the context? Obama sent a coward to hide behind anonymity in order to say that Netanyahu is a coward for what? For one, not being willing to make the, to take the political risk of doing the right thing by honestly negotiating a Palestinian state. And two, he's just bluffing about attacking Iran. He ain't got the guts. Well, do you really want to mock him and tempt him along those lines? I agree. I think he mostly was bluffing, but, you know, you might try it. Remember, Dick Cheney's old plan was to get Ehud Olmert to attack Iran and just force George Bush into it. You have no choice but to back Israel now. That was the vice president's idea. He sent David Sanger to go and shop it around. Steve Clemens broke the story and the New York Times confirmed it. Washington Post double confirmed it back then in 2007. Dick Cheney and is insubordinate. And his staff is going around blabbing about it. Dick Cheney wants to use the Israelis to force George Bush into a war that he doesn't trust George Bush to do the right thing to start. And you may be able to hear hammers banging in the background. They're finally cleaning up the kook nest next door. So a little bit of construction going on, but I'm happy about it. Hope it's not interrupting the show for you too bad. Anyway, oh, that's just them building new settlements in East Jerusalem over there. Hammer, hammer, hammer. Sorry about your property rights. Ha 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 ha. You know, stuff like that, I think, is what they say. Again, I don't know the Hebrew. I just, you know, I'm roughly paraphrasing. And then, of course, there's a crisis now at the Al-Aqsa Mosque where a right-wing American rabbi, Yehuda Glick, was shot. He survived. I believe he was shot by an Arab Muslim. I don't know. I think so. Yeah. Mu'taz Hijazi was the accused and was killed. Anyway, and so then, now the deal with the mosque there is the Israeli army occupies it, I think mostly to limit Israeli Jewish access to it, which of course is a big double-edged sword for the Palestinians who go there to pray. It's the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and it's under foreign occupation, but then again, they're keeping the most right-wing, crazy religious Jews from destroying the Al-Aqsa Mosque and attempting to rebuild the Temple of Solomon there and start sacrificing animals and stuff and start a world war. So it's kind of a delicate situation, you see. Beware of that red heifer, man. He'll get you. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show. Land Day coming up. Talk about the war for a minute. I got some news for you here. New from the Washington Post, how the Islamic State evolved in an American prison. I only just got this. I don't know what's the sourcing for it or anything else, but I already know it's Camp Buka is where these guys were for 4 or 5 years, where they locked up the Bin Ladenites with the Ba'athists and helped create that hybrid ideology of the Islamic State. Bin Ladenites in the political positions, Ba'athists run in the military. So anyway, not to overplay, you know, the danger, because there never was one really, but the biggest danger, as I've said for many months now before the fall of Mosul or any of that, the biggest danger is that these guys are going to attack inside the United States in order to lure us into fighting over there again. For the exact same reason that they've been attacking the United States for 25 years, 30 years. Well, 25 years. To lure us in. To bog us down and bleed us to bankruptcy. All right. So there's a new article by Tom Englehart today. And it's about, he talks about Ebola too to kind of make the point, but really he's writing about the war. And what he's saying is, well, let's see, the article here is building an escalation machine, the pressure to escalate. And, you know, I really should have had him on the show about this, because what he talks about, he goes through all the examples of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and other military men just blatantly contradicting the president repeatedly. When the president says, and listen, I think he's lying, because Obama's no dummy, and he knows the path that he's on here is to eventual escalation. But still, he is the president, and they're just generals. You can tell he is superior in authority to them because they're wearing olive green and he's wearing a pinstripe suit, see? That's why he's the boss and they're not. And so he says, no troops. Advisors, yeah. And he's already sending special forces out there with laser pointers. Supposedly. CIA's there. A couple of thousand troops, really, at this point. But Obama claims to want them to stay behind the lines and let others do the fighting. And yet the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and others have repeatedly said, oh, yeah, no, we're going to go ahead and send in troops at some point. Hey, if I think I need them, I'm going to tell the president so, and this and that. And Obama keeps coming out and saying, no, really, I meant what I said, and I said what I meant, and all of that. And then they keep saying, yeah, but, you know, we might have to put boots on the ground. And then Hagel came out and blurred the whole thing and said, hey, we already have guys there, and it's a war zone, so it already is boots on the ground, so let's quit being dishonest about that. But so who's he contradicting there, the president or the generals? And the point is, though, that they're all correct. Everyone agrees. You're about to hear Lande say, man, this policy's falling apart. Who's doing what here? What are we going to do? What is the deal? Now, of course, my answer is nothing. My answer is abolish the entire U.S. military and the entire CIA and the entire U.S. government. Entirely. Then it can't do anything. And then we'll all be better off. That is the real solution to the problem. The next best thing to that is keep America out starting yesterday. Get everybody who's there out now. And don't put anyone back in. And don't help and don't send arms to anyone. And don't back the Iranians and don't back the Turks, the Saudis, the Syrians, or anybody else. The Sunni tribes, just quit. That's the real answer. But everyone else in foreign policy land is saying, well, this ain't working, I guess. The pressure to escalate. There's nothing else for them to do except send more, shoot more, blow up more. What's the opposite of that? Go cold turkey? Just stop? Sit back and say, yep, we completely ruined the Middle East. Caused a civil war that got 1 million-plus people killed, now working on another couple of 100,000 on the western end of the same civil war. It's going to go on for another couple of generations. Maybe many, many more people will die as all the new lines, you know, become solidified. As really Riyadh and Tehran face off for the long term here. Hasn't America done enough? Can you imagine Washington, D.C. adopting that policy only under Ron Paul? If Ron Paul had been the president elected in 08 or in 12, then yes. And he would have said, oh yeah, no, I expect the Middle East to burn. And it sucks. But no, I'm not pretending for a minute that we're going to fix it. Are you crazy? The American government is the one what set that region on fire. And he would have said, yes, no, it's tragic over there, man. Slavery, beheadings, crucifixion, civil war. You wouldn't have heard him playing down the evil being perpetrated. He would have just said, tough. I mean, hey, that's why we shouldn't have backed the murderer torturers that we backed against these guys who grew up to oppose them. That's the real truth. And he was calling the score all along from the floor of the U.S. House. So It could have been Ron, but other than that, well, it's all fantasy. Other than that, they gotta escalate, and they're going to escalate, and they're gonna escalate, escalate, escalate. What else can they do? You know, there's an article here in the New York Times. Where's that freaking New York Times crap? Iraqis prepare ISIS offensive with U.S. help. This is from November 2nd by Michael Gordon, who almost lied us into war with Iran in 2007. Who did lie us into war with Iraq in 2002 and 3. He was Judith Miller's co-author on Saddam's quest for A-bomb parts and all the rest of that crap. Michael Gordon, the disgrace. Anyway, so he's got this piece here where they say the goal is to train up the Iraqi army and the Shiite militias to fight the war next year and to drive the Islamic State out of Mosul by the end of 2015. Really? Or I don't know, man. With the Republicans in control of the Senate? I don't know. And what's Obama going to do? He's going to do what he's told. He can only hold out for so long. Because what's the opposite of that? Him coming out and saying, "No, damn it! I was elected to never again invade Iraq, and damn it, I'm not gonna, and I don't care what's on fire. Forget it. And any of you generals don't like it, quit. I mean it." You think he's gonna do that? So no, he's just like in 2009, just like in 2011, he's gonna get down on his belly and crawl before his masters in the Pentagon, and he's gonna do what they want. They're going to wait until more than a year from now to have driven the Islamic State from Mosul. They're going to have Baghdadi up on this balcony or that one, calling himself Caliph Ibrahim. Bin Laden incarnate as a head of state over there. They're going to let that stand for more than a year? I mean, hell, God bless them if they are. I say don't do nothing, but I'm skeptical. Midterms are over today, then what? Hey, all, Scott Horton here. I want to tell you about this great new book, Livin' La Vida Baroka, American Culture in an Age of Imperial Orthodoxies by Thomas Harrington. While he comes from the left, Harrington has little time for much of what is passed off under that label today. Like us libertarians, he puts peace and freedom first. The book's got great essays on American fascism, empire, the Israeli occupation, the left and Obama, liberalism in the state, and some interesting lessons from the history of Imperial Spain. Livin' La Vida Baroka by Thomas Harrington. Check it out at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. All right, I'm writing down a giant note to myself. I gotta call Ian about what he did to the wizard here. That just ain't how it's supposed to go. All right. Okay. I got Lande on the phone. Where'd he go? I lost him. I got him. He'll be here in just a second. Jonathan Lande, he is back in Iraq reporting for McClatchy Newspapers. Welcome back to the show, Jonathan. How are you?
It's good to be with you again, Scott.
Very happy to have you back on the show. Very important piece you have here at McClatchyDC.com. Slaughter of Anbar tribesmen shows weakness in U.S. plan to beat Islamic State. And you're talking about the Albu Nimr tribe. As you say here, one of Anbar's largest Sunni Muslim tribes. Please tell us all about it.
So the Albu Nimr live in western.
Oh no! Sorry,
the Albu Nimr live in western. Yeah, okay. So start again. So the Albu Nimr live in western Iraq, quite far out. A lot of it in the desert, and they've been fighting off attacks by the Islamic State since the Islamic State launched its offensive this summer. In particular, there's been a lot of fighting around the city of Heat. And about 10 days or so ago, the Islamic State attacked a town of the Albu Nimr, overran it after the defenders agreed to stop fighting and to withdraw, and were given a pledge of that their civilians would be spared. After the fighters left the town, the Islamic State reneged on that pledge. They killed more than 40, or executed in public more than 40 of their prisoners, and evicted thousands of civilians, at least according to leaders of the Abu Nimer, and pursued them through the desert. We're told that more than 400 of them have now been slaughtered. The reason that this is important is because it is one of an example of clashes between the Anbar tribes, who are Sunni, and the extremists, these Sunni extremists, in which the tribes contend they've received absolutely no help from the Iraqi army or government, and pleadings for U.S. airstrikes. And this has sort of added to a list of long list of grievances that the tribesmen, these Sunni tribesmen, hold against the Shiite-led government in Baghdad and against the army. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, it's one of a number of hurdles that are facing this plan by President Obama to re-enlist the Sunni tribes who participated in the awakening during the American occupation of Iraq, and turning them against the Islamic State.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, okay, when we talked back in April, this would have made sense from Maliki's point of view, that it's good politics among the Shia that he's their protector from the Sunni extremists, this kind of thing. But now you've had, you know, 6 or 8 pages worth of history have turned since then. And Maliki's gone. You have the new guy, Abadi. And I could understand, okay, they don't want to arm up these Sunni tribes that they don't like, but they really? They don't want to arm them up even against the Islamic State when these guys are fighting for their lives against the Islamic State? Why in the hell not? It's not like it's going to blow back on them that bad in this particular instance, right?
Well, that's one of the things they're concerned about. And let's not forget about the makeup of this government. It's dominated by Shiite religious parties who control the Shiite militias that are, in fact, the most effective fighting force now on behalf of the government. And these parties don't want to see the Sunni tribes rearmed. And at least some people believe that neither does Iran, which is the patron of these Shiite religious parties and these Shiite militias here in Iraq. And so it's an enormous frustration to the Anbar tribes, the Sunni tribes, and it's a major obstacle to the Obama administration's strategy for crushing the Islamic State, because Washington is saying that unless the government arms these tribes, it is not going to provide military advisors to the bereft Iraqi army as it tries to repulse the Islamic State in Anbar province. So Washington wants these tribes armed in return for sending U.S. advisors to Anbar to help the army, which is in fact withdrawn into its major bases and is surrounded in many cases and besieged by the Islamic State. 80% of this province, which makes up about 1/3 of Iraq, is under the control of the Islamic State. It's a very, very strategic piece of land. A lot of it's barren desert, but it borders Saudi Arabia, it borders Syria, and it borders Jordan, and it borders 5 other Iraqi provinces. And so it's basically a roadway from which the Islamic State can shift men and materiel from Syria to the outskirts of Baghdad to 5 other Iraqi provinces, and can threaten the Shiite holy cities of Karbala and Najaf.
Right. Well, but it sounds like you're saying the Iranians have decided, which they are the power behind the Dawa Party and the Supreme Islamic Council, the Badr Corps and all that, and they've decided long ago, and it doesn't sound like they've changed their mind about this. They don't really care who rules Sunnistan as long as it's not them. They're not so dumb as to try to bite off that much more than they can chew, and so they basically, they're not willing to help the tribe. They don't want another awakening, even if it means the tribes beating Baghdadi. They don't care if it's Baghdadi or the tribes. Just don't come to Baghdad. Come to Karbala, right?
Well, I'm not sure. If that's the case, it's awfully short-sighted, Scott, because that means they will have constant warfare on the borders of the southern half of Iraq, which is where the majority Shia live. They will have constant bombings in Baghdad. They will, you know. No, can you hear me?
Yeah, I think the Border Corps was cutting out your bandwidth a little bit there, but try again.
No, we just have terrible. There's a terrible internet here.
Yeah. So no, you're doing pretty good. Go ahead.
Okay. So, I mean, if the Iranians are in fact trying to keep the tribes from being armed and being turned against the Islamic State, it's pretty short-sighted.
Yeah. Well, I mean, their policy always has been really to support those who support strong federalism, meaning break the country up. I mean, it would be crazy for them to try to really have. I mean, we saw in practice when the Shiite army tries to occupy Mosul, they'd turn and run at the first shot fired because it's not their territory, it's somebody else's city. So they turn and flee. What are they going to do? Dominate it forever?
Well, but as I said, Scott, it would be awfully short-sighted to allow the breakup of Iraq because the Iranians would have constant violence.
No, I agree with you. Yeah, the whole thing's evil. You know? I mean, they helped get a million people killed
in
the last 10 years.
Don't forget, it would strengthen the Islamic State, which is also, don't forget, fighting in Syria next door. It is the strongest of the insurgent forces. Bashar Assad, and to allow them to maintain a huge chunk of Iraq would be very counterproductive for the Iranians' effort to keep Assad in power.
Right. But then again, if America goes in there and backs the Iranian and Shiite militias and AKA Iraqi army and all these groups to try to really defeat and vanquish the Islamic State, that's just like throwing gasoline right on the fire rather than water, right?
Except that's essentially what's going on now. Don't forget, at least here in Iraq, we've had, you know, these American airstrikes, more than 3 months worth, and a lot of them have been in support of operations in which the Iranian-backed Shia militia are involved, and in fact, elements of the Quds force, which is the elite of the elite Islamic Revolutionary Guard of Iran.
Right.
And so there is kind of a de facto cooperation going on even now. And I think, you know, some of these Sunni tribes, like this Sheikh of the Al-Ghud, the Sheikh of the Abu Nimr, who I've been speaking to for the last week, mm-hmm. has gotten so desperate to save his people that he is willing to accept offers from 30 Shiite tribes in the south to send their gunmen to go help protect his people, his Sunni people, mm-hmm. in Anbar province. Wow. That's how desperate the situation has become.
Man. All right. Well, you know, the audio has just gotten so terrible, and I know you got to go, so we'll end it here. But thank you. Great reporting again, Jonathan. That's it. He's gone. All right, y'all. That's the great Jonathan Lande. Back in just a sec. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. Yeah, well, guess the Iranians don't like it when you talk about their foreign policy in Iraq. Was that them throttling down Lande's bandwidth there? Nah, I'm just being silly. Probably. Good interview from Lande. He ended up sounding like crap at the end there, but I'll tell you what, man. I'm reminded of the feeling from 2002. I remember saying on Chaos Radio, I have the clip somewhere, actually. In 2002, saying, man, you know, America started a lot of wars before, but I am unaware of any time that they have announced we have this premeditated murder plot And we're going to tell you an unending series of lies for the next year and a half. Whatever it takes to get you to say it's okay to let us start a war. It's just, it was unreal. And the whole reason they had to go to the UN was because there was no pretext to self-defense at all. Going to the UN, that's how you legalize an aggressive war. Aggressive war is the greatest war crime, unless you can get consensus with France and Russia and China, in which case it's perfectly great. And it was just, it was unreal, man. And then, of course, seeing everyone else going, yeah, whatever Bush says, he's our leader, he knows what's best, kill them all. Oh my God. What's the same kind of unreal Twilight Zone sort of thing? And who could have guessed? In regards to invading Iraq again here, where the story of what the war even is, what the policy even is, whose side we're even on, is absolutely crazy. On the face of it, again, I can't get over it. It just can't work. Robert Mary over there at the National Interest says, well, this can't work. And Huzitz over at the Council on Foreign Relations says, this can't work. And F-Face over at the Foundation for Defense of Democracy says, this can't work, and it's, what are you talking about? You're doing what? You're gonna back the Iranians and their torture murderer squads against these Sunni torture murderer squads. At the same time, you have the State Department of white Christians and Jews from Europe, of European descent, telling the would-be recruits to the Islamic State that they are heretics. Oh, yeah, that's really going to convince them. Yeah, a white lady with red hair over at the State Department said that I'm a heretic and that I'm not living up to my religion right. Does that sound about right? Boy, I better do what she says, they all say to each other. Really? Okay. Good plans there. Turn away. That's their, they have a whole thing, like, I don't know if they got Karen Hughes and Condi Rice to make this thing up. It's the turn away program. Look again. Look away. Turn away or something. Oh my God. You got people, you know, who sell, cornflakes and stuff for a living, trying to sell would-be recruits to the Islamic State that they're heretics and don't know the first thing about living their religion right. Yeah, yeah, that's, great plan. And then on the other side, they're going to train up the moderates. Yeah, the moderates. Well, here we go. In Syria, that is. From the Telegraph, Syrian rebels armed and trained by the United States surrender to Al-Qaeda. So-called moderates, which just means they're criminals rather than religious ideologues. Moderate rebels in Syria that the U.S. have armed and trained to fight jihadists have surrendered to Al-Qaeda. Two of the main rebel groups receiving weapons from the U.S. to fight both the regime and jihadist groups in Syria have surrendered to the Al-Nusra Front. The U.S. and its allies were relying on, that's just Al-Qaeda in Syria. The U.S. and its allies were relying on Harakat Hazm. And the Syrian Revolutionary Front to become part of a ground force that would attack ISIS and Assad. They left out right there. Gave them Grad rockets and TOW missiles. But on Saturday night, Harakat Hazm surrendered military bases and weapons supplies to Jabhat al-Nusra when the Al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria stormed villages they controlled in northern Idlib province. The development came a day after Jabhat al-Nusra dealt a final blow to the Syrian Revolutionary Front, storming and capturing Deir Sinbal, hometown of the group's leader, Jamal Maarouf. The attack caused the group, which had already lost its territory in Hama to Al-Qaeda, to surrender. As a movement, the SRF is effectively finished, said this guy Tamimi, who, he's kind of shifty, but I don't know. Knows what he's talking about most, I guess. A Syria analyst. Nusra has driven them out of their strongholds of Idlib and Hama. So there's that. And then Roy Gutman at McClatchy, U.S.-backed forces in Syria suffer big setback. Al-Qaeda-backed militants Saturday stormed the base of the most prominent civilian commander, forcing him and his fighters to flee. Jamal Maarouf, a contractor in private life, blah, blah, blah. Oh, see, it starts out that way, telling the same story, but wait. Oh, did they change the story at the URL? Or did I lose the URL? No, see, this is the important part. Blam, fast forward down till you get down here, and then Islamic State fighters join Nusra in the attack. The two groups have been divided. Oh, see, I think they rewrote this. Now it has an if there. Muhammad al-Yugal, a commander in Maruf's force, told McClatchy the militant fighters had deployed at least 20 heavy machine guns. He said the Nusra fighters used tanks, mortars, and Chechen snipers in the battle for Deir Sinbul, Maruf's hometown. Yugal said the fighters had traveled by convoy across the Syrian desert, an assertion that coincided with information McClatchy obtained from another Syrian rebel commander early in the week as the convoy was reportedly setting out. McClatchy contacted both U.S. Central Command and they had no comment. If Islamic State fighters in fact join Nusra in the attack, it will have major repercussions for the war in Syria. For the two groups have been divided since April 2013 when Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the Iraq-based leader, announced the creation of the Islamic State. Well, sort of, he called it, yeah. Anyway, didn't quite declare the caliphate then, but halfway, I guess. Nusra had supported the rebel war against Assad until very recently. Oh, yeah, see, I emailed Roy about this, and I never heard back. Nusra had supported the rebel war against Assad until very recently, and also was at war with the Islamic State. Well, that's the first I heard of Nusra stopped fighting Assad's group. In fact, didn't I just read about Nusra? Yeah, Robert Fisk. I may even still have this article from Fisk here about... No, but I read it to you on the show last week, parts of it. Where he was there with the Syrian military commander as the Nusra force seized a military base in Idlib and beheaded a bunch of senior-level military officers. Dozens of them. Well, more than two dozen, I guess. Yeah, so that's dozens. Two or three dozen. And then, anyway, so then as Lande's reporting to us here, you have the only hope for the war against the Islamic State that makes any sense whatsoever is the Sunni tribal leaders in what's now independent Sunnistan in western and northwestern Iraq to take up arms to fight the Islamic State. They're the ones who've been conquered, really. And yet, nope, America's partners in Baghdad, the same ones America's been backing since 2003 there, backed by Iran as well, more so, and as well, as Lande's reporting, they don't want to do that. You heard him protesting, but that's crazy. Yeah, but Lande, you're the one reporting it. The Iranian government and its proxies in Iraq have decided that they are not, at least for now, in this instance, anyway, sounds like a pretty important instance. They're not willing to lend Iraq government support, assuming they can, lend any help or support or arms or money or anything to try to help these Sunni tribesmen in the town of Heat, which is on the far side of Fallujah from Baghdad. And I think on the far side of Bakuba from there, although I'm not the very best at Iraqi geography. I really should study that better. But anyway, they're kind of way out there, as he said, but he also has in the story where the Shiite leaders, the Badr Corps and the Dawah Party guys, man, they're not interested in helping the Sunni tribesmen at all. Even if it means they're stuck with the Islamic State too. And Lande says, but that's incredibly short-sighted. And I say, yeah, you're exactly right. It's crazy. But this is where Iranian and Israeli and American policy have really come to some sort of agreement. And really, the Saudis, too. I mean, the Saudis would have preferred that the Sunnis be able to hold on to the capital city. But since they can't have it back, at least for now, I think they obviously prefer independence for Sunnistan over their domination by the Shia. They should have got their... They should have got their American allies to not do that. Well, that was the end of the show, and I didn't hear the music, so... Oops. See you tomorrow. Hey, Al Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at WholeFoodComplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics. No chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed at WholeFoodComplete.com.